politically correct or not in consensus, there will be large groups of people in this country calling themselves Christian, Stan, which will be going along with most of the agendas. We'll see no difference or conflict between your faith and what's happening. And so when we say Christian, you really have to qualify that.
And I think that the church growth movement that's sweeping America now is the great apostasy that's described in the scriptures, because they've changed the message of the church. They've changed the nature of God in the church growth movement. And I know you've interviewed Robert Klink on that, but it's so important that people understand that the Christians, the good people of this country, are being led astray by false leaders who have another agenda. And they've changed the nature of God. God is only a God of love. He's never a God of justice or judgment or wrath or vengeance. Oh, no, that's the God of the Old Testament. You mean there was a different God in the Old Testament than there is in the New Testament? I don't believe that for one minute. In fact, I tremble for my country, as Jefferson said when I reflected, God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever.
You know, it's important to understand not only that, but also that the fact that the eschatology that people have affects how they view this whole conflict. And more importantly, the view that each particular religious denomination has of the scriptures, the Bible, as whether or not it is the Word of God or not. In other words, whether we begin allegorizing large parts of it away, etc. And that was the thing that Francis Schaeffer warned about a generation ago, which would be the dividing line between all of the churches, because he said as the church has rejected the inerrancy and the authority of the scriptures and moved in the direction of accepting the dialectical process, which you and I have talked about, and we see this process, by the way, playing out in the Episcopalian church right now. That's what you're seeing happening right there, is this cleavage. He said ultimately those churches that went in that direction would not be able to stand against the spirit of the age. He said every age has had a spirit which has stood in opposition to God, and only the true church at that time was able to stand against it. But he said once this church adopts it, any church that adopts the dialectical process will then ultimately begin to look more and more and more like the world. And that is exactly what's happening now. This is how what happened in the Presbyterian denomination, the Roman Catholic denomination, the Lutherans, many of the Lutheran denominations, the Episcopalian church, is now happening inside the evangelical and fundamentalist and Pentecostal churches by means of church growth. It's the very same process. It erodes it away from inside. But there will be large, you know, Barrett has always reminded me of this, Stan. There will always be large quantities of people calling themselves Christians who do not understand what that really means. And the world will always point to them and say, see, these are the reasonable, the open-minded Christians, the enlightened ones. It's these other bigots or closed-minded people, the ones who are unadaptable to change, as Dean Gocher would put it, that are the ones that we have to take care of.
And people do not understand. They've written about this. If you read the writings of Barbara Marx Hubbard, and we have the original text of her book, The Revelation, the Book of Co-Creation, she talks about the necessity of killing a quarter of the world's population that will not evolve to a higher level of consciousness. Who is Barbara Marx Hubbard? Why, she's a member of the board of directors of the World Future Society, along with Marie Strong and Robert Strange McNamara. It used to be that their logo was a circle made up of three sixes. They've changed it after we began to talk about it. But then, of course, she ran for the vice presidential nomination in 1994 on the Democratic ticket to get the Democratic nomination for vice president, consultant to our government. She talks about the necessity of killing a quarter of the world's population. Marie Strong, and we have the pages off the webpage before they were deleted, talks about the necessity to eliminate fundamentalist Christians, Jews, and Muslims. And this is one thing we're doing today, is we are eliminating the fundamentalist Muslims in the name of...
good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line right now Joel Marbury. We're going to be talking about his book, Dangerous Diplomacy. Mr. Marbury, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing fine. And certainly, you've written this book. You work for National Review magazine, and you start out talking about how you were stopped there at a State Department briefing one day after you'd asked a rather embarrassing question. And you want to tell that story? I thought it was fascinating.
Well, I mean, I think that I have to give a little bit of background here. My beat has been the State Department now for a couple of years, and I covered it, as you mentioned, for National Review. And in the course of covering the State Department, I don't really come to this issue, by the way, with much of an axe grind. Like most people, I really didn't have an opinion about the State Department, even say 2 years ago. But then I came across this program that someone had tipped me off about that let in three of the 9/11 terrorists in the 3 months it was open before September 11th. And that it was still open. Now, I thought, of course, that the person who told me this was crazy. But being a good journalist, I decided to follow up. And it turns out that this program known as Visa Express, the name given to it by the State Department, was still operating in the country where 15 of 19 September 11th terrorists came from. And people in that country, every resident, was submitting visa applications to come to the United States at private Saudi travel agents, even after 3,000 Americans had died in a single day.
Joel, I want to interrupt you. Are you on a regular telephone, because you're cutting in and out?
Yeah, actually, I am on a regular telephone.
You're on a regular hardline telephone?
Well, it's a cordless phone, so I apologize.
Do you have access to a regular phone, because this one's cutting out?
We might just have a bad connection.
All right, well, how about I have my producer call you right back, because I think what you're saying is so important. So you'll hang up, and I'll ask Herman just to call you right back, all right?
Sounds good. Thanks.
All right, you're welcome. Herman, would you call Mr. Marbury back again? Because he's talking about after September 11th, the Saudi government was actually, the American State Department was allowing Saudis to come in here under something called the Visa Express. And under the Visa Express, nobody interviewed the Saudis before they came in. Now, 15 of the 19 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia, and yet we're allowing them to come in here. And I'm going to have to hold just a moment. They were allowing the Saudis to continue coming in here without being interviewed. And if you know anything about Saudi Arabia, you know that their country is Wahhabi. And the basic religion of Wahhabism promotes terrorism. And so our State Department is allowing people to come in from Saudi Arabia. And they inaugurated this program several weeks before. I think it was was in mid-June. So June, July, August, September, about 3 months before September 11th. And several of the terrorists who came under this Visa Express system, where you were allowed to come into the country, just go to your travel agency, he'll get you a visa, in total violation of all of the rules of our State Department. Well, it was one thing to have done that before September 11th, but they continued the same policies after September 11th. So let's go ahead, Joel, and pick the story up from there.
Well, anyway, I reported on this story called Visa Express, and I thought the State Department's reaction would be, oh my gosh, we had no idea that this program was operating from within our own institution. And so, lo and behold, I thought they would change it, but they didn't. They defended it to the hilt. When they defended it, they went about attacking me at the daily press briefing. So I started attending what they have, you know, these daily press briefings where people ask questions, the reporters ask questions. And at one of these press briefings, I'd done almost about a month of nonstop stories on this program, Vista Express. And after about a month, of these stories, I was at a daily press briefing. Now, I had obtained a cable, a classified memo sent from the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia back to Washington, in which the ambassador requested that the program, Vista Express, be shut down. And the State Department, I was asking this of Richard Boucher at the State Department. He's the press spokesman, the bearded, emotionless, slightly creepy guy. Well, anyway, so when I asked him, I said, you know, is it true that the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia has requested that the program formerly known as Vista Express, because when I made my story, they only dropped the name Vista Express, making it like the artist Prince, the program formerly known as Vista Express. I said, is it true that this program has been shut down? And he said, you know, the ambassador requested this program to be shut down. And he said, no. And, of course, this cable I had was very clear because the subject line of the cable was request for guidance on termination of Vista Express.
No, that was the American.
Richard Boucher was lying to me.
No, the American ambassador to Saudi Arabia wanted to stop this. He realized that there was no screening at all to see if there were more terrorists coming into the United States after September 11th, and the State Department denied the cable was ever sent, even though they know it had been.
Right. And so when I asked this of Richard Boucher, I was expecting an honest answer, but certainly not a lie. So he and I then had a contentious exchange right there at the daily press briefing. And as I was attempting to leave a few minutes early, I was stopped by a middle-aged blonde-haired woman from the press office, as well as four armed guards. And they would not let me leave the building. They detained me for 30 minutes, and they tried to determine who my source was.
And they were going to just detain you there until you told them. You got the word out to a national review and told them
yes.
What was happening. And so eventually they let you go. But they were furious that you had the truth, that they were allowing potential terrorists to still come in the country after 3,000 Americans had been killed.
Yes. And as a result, they detained me. And that's what really led me to kind of dig in even deeper to the State Department. And I realized that there was a pattern of behavior here, something that went much deeper than just the question of visas.
And, of course, then you began looking into this, and you found out a very cozy relationship between the U.S. State Department and the Saudi government. In fact, so many of the State Department officials who worked on Middle Eastern affairs, after they left their jobs with government, went to work and got nice fat salaries either directly from the Saudis, or they got it from foundations that were funded by the Saudis, and there was an awful lot of money that was being spent to buy the goodwill at the State Department. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, and that's one of the other things that I report on in great detail in Dangerous Diplomacy, is just how all of that had taken place. Now, it's hard, I know, for a lot of people to believe that you know, some of these things happen, which is why I actually include in the book, a document appendix where people can see in black and white with their own two eyes where they have such policies as if a travel agent, and I'm quoting here, if a travel agent is reasonably satisfied that that the traveler has the means to purchase a tour package, then there will be little further examination done of the applicant's qualifications.
But, of course, what you're doing is taking somebody who has a vested financial interest in selling a travel package to the United States and making him the determinant of whether this man would qualify to come in under U.S. law. And,
yes.
Of course, that's not what that's not his job. That's a consular job. And yet the consul in the embassy was not allowed to see these people. In fact, nobody saw these people till they got here to the United States, and at least three of the hijackers who were responsible for 9/11 had come in or under this Visa Express program.
Yes, indeed. And that's why I really stuck with this as much as I did, and it was unfortunate that the State Department decided to take the course they did, but that's really, again, what showed me the true nature of their character.
Now, how long did they keep Visa Express in? Or I know they changed the name, of course, but a rose by any other name still is still a rose. So they kept that in place really for many months after 9/11, didn't they?
Yes, for about 10 months until Congress finally shut it down shortly after the time of my detainment.
So basically what happens is that we have a group of bureaucrats, many of whom are know that if they're really nice to the Saudis, that they'll end up with nice fat pensions or nice fat jobs or nice appointments on these think tanks where they'll get a nice salary. So if they go along with Saudi Arabia, why, don't rock the boat, give the Saudis whatever they want, and really don't worry about the American people or the threat of terrorism.
Yeah, I think that's... That more or less is a fair summary. I mean, it's not that they're anti-American or treasonous. They just really think that the best way to represent America's interests is by making all these other foreign countries and governments happy with us. So they go out of their way to do favors for people like the Saudis.
Well, now, you talk about the one time when one of the Saudi princes was coming over here, and on his plane was one man who was wanted by government here, and then there were two people on the terrorist watch list, and they were being brought in. The Saudis had given them certainly visas to come to the United States. He had cleared them to come here, knowing full well that two of them were on the terrorist watch list. The FBI wanted to arrest them. The State Department didn't want anything done, and certainly didn't want to arrest the man who was already wanted by law enforcement here. What happened when this incident occurred?
Well, the FBI wanted to go on and board the plane, and they wanted to take these people who were with Crown Prince Abdullah on his part of the delegation during his visit to President Bush in Crawford, Texas, at the Western White House. And when the people at the FBI wanted to go in, the folks at the State Department said absolutely not, because they did not want what they call an international incident where these people would be embarrassed.
So basically we seem to find that the people in the State Department really are not interested in the safety of the American people. They seem to have their own agenda, which is just get along with the Saudis no matter what happens.
Well, they actually think that that is in the best interest of America. I mean, to be fair to them, they are not treasonous or anti-American, just that their actions are.
All right. Now, of course, we see the same thing over and over again. They always seem to favor the Islamists, and it doesn't really matter where they are, Saudi Arabia, but they knew that there were terrorists training over there in the Middle East. They knew that the terrorist movement was being financed by Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabi religion, which is the very kernel of the very core of this whole Islamic terrorist movement, is centered in Saudi Arabia. Aren't they interested in stopping terrorism? Is all this talk about fighting terrorism simply to placate the American people? Because it doesn't seem like we're really fighting terrorism very effectively. We can't even find Osama bin Laden.
Well, I guess I'm not an expert on the FBI or on the CIA, but I do know that what really matters when it comes to preventing terrorism is the removal of despotic regimes. If not overnight, certainly over time, and that's where diplomacy comes in. When you push people who are your allies to embrace American values, slowly implementing the institutions of freedom over time. It can happen. We've seen tyrannies in places such as South Korea, Taiwan, and Chile move into the free market democracy category, but only with, after the pressure from the United States pushing them in that direction.
Well, but then we'll look at what happened, what we've done in Zimbabwe, where we brought a Marxist dictator to power, and now they have a totalitarian state. The same thing, we're backing the regime there in Angola.
And one of the things I talk about in the book, actually.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that.
Is defending Robert Mugabe in court. He lost judgment for over $70 million to five victims of the torture campaign run up to the 2000 election there. And when they sued him in U.S. courts, pursuant to U.S. law, the State Department actually actively worked against the victims of torture and sided with Robert Mugabe.
Now, what was the background of the torture, and who was he torturing?
He was torturing Zimbabweans who dared to stand up to him in trying to push for democratic change in Zimbabwe.
Now, where was the trial then held? Was it held here or whereabouts?
Well, it was a civil trial for damages, and it was held held here in the United States.
It was held here in the United States, and so we find our State Department coming down on the side of the torturers and this Marxist dictator, which is what Mugabe is. Why would our State Department back a communist dictator, a ruthless tyrant like Robert Mugabe? Because we brought him to power back in 1974, 1975, and now, of course, we're still backing him 20 years later. There's no question what he was. He's the same today as he was then.
Well, that's exactly correct. But what the State Department has to an obsession with stability and with making friends. So they want the world to look the same as it always has, which would be great if the world looked like the United States, but it doesn't. And, you know, when you look at the hornet's nest of draconian despotism that is the Middle East, you'd think the last thing anyone would want is more of the same. Yet that's exactly what the State Department wants. And that's the reason why they think they need to be nice to the likes of Saudi Arabia and North Korea and Iran and places like that, because they honestly believe that it is their job to have these countries like us so they'll be willing to sit down at the bargaining table to hash out agreements. Never mind that Ronald Reagan, I think, really set the example when he called the Soviet Union the evil empire and then proceeded to have more deals with the Soviets than any regime, than any president before him.
Well, of course, we've seen how we handled North Korea. I mean, we supply them with food, and we supply them with oil, and we're building so they can have electricity, and we're building a nuclear plant for them. All of these things only strengthen the hand of the ruthless tyrant who runs the country, and then we say, gee, he's a terrible ruthless tyrant, he's got to be replaced. Maybe if we kept backing some of these people, why, the people there would rise up and overthrow them.
Well, you know, there's even in a situation like in a country like Iran, where you have a strong democratic movement, but the State Department doesn't want to back them. The State Department actually wants to side with the Iranian mullahs over the students seeking democracy there, because if you back the students, then you're going to risk instability.
Well, of course, but people have forgotten. I'm old enough to remember 1979 when we had a man in power there. He may not have been a perfect individual, but he was a very enlightened despot. His name was the Shah of Iran, and we toppled the Shah, and we brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. We paid off the military just not to, do anything at all, and just exactly as we'd brought the Shah to power back in 54 by toppling Mossadegh, we toppled the Shah in 79, we brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power, and then we wonder why there's a radical regime there in Iran, which we are still backing. In other words, we're not backing the democratic movement. You would think occasionally the State Department might do something that would be beneficial for the cause of freedom.
Not that they don't like freedom, but freedom oftentimes entails an awful lot of instability. And that's the honest answer.
You honestly believe that they're just afraid of instability, so they don't want the people to have, they'd rather have them have a dictator than freedom?
Yes.
All right, fine. Now, has anybody has anybody in the State Department ever given that as an explanation?
Well, they do, actually. They talk about the need for stability, which is why they backed Saddam Hussein in the late 80s after the end of the Iran-Iraq War, when there was no strategic reason to back him anymore. And they did it even after the gassing of the Kurds. And as perverse as this sounds, it was because of the gassing of the Kurds that they forged closer ties with him, because they believed that after he killed 100,000 people in a single month, that he would be eaten alive by the international community if they didn't do anything to protect him.
But you know, the hypocrisy of that, Joel, is the fact that now that we're telling the American people, oh, we found these mass graves, and they're just full of all these people, and women and little children and men, hundreds of thousands of people killed by Saddam Hussein. They were killed, you know, with a full...
Which is why we actually owe a greater commitment to Iran.
Right, but the reason they were killed is because we allowed Saddam to take his helicopter gunships up in the air and kill these people when they rose up, when we told them to rise up. You rise up to overthrow Saddam Hussein, we'll come and help you. They believed George Herbert Walker Bush. They rose up, and they were slaughtered by the tens of thousands, well over 100,000 slaughtered. Those are the mass graves we're talking about. But they don't. Have you noticed that nobody ever mentions that now, that it was those people that were slaughtered because they believed George Herbert Walker Bush that are in those graves that we're finding?
You know, I do talk in great detail about how the State Department backed Saddam Hussein in the late 80s. And in fact, there was a period I have a whole chapter called Quitting to Dawn. It's the longest chapter in the book. There was a two-week period in late August and early September of 1988 where the State Department refused to even criticize Saddam for killing 100,000 of his own people in a single month.
Could you speak up just a little? Because that's what the State Department refused to criticize him after killing 100,000 of his people. Is that what you said?
Yes.
And the Americans...
killed 100,000 people in a single month. The State Department did not want to even criticize him for doing that because they feared that they would anger an ally.
So they looked upon Saddam Hussein as an ally, and yet today he's supposedly this wicked man who has rape houses and kills and tortures people. He's the same man we backed all that time. That is total hypocrisy on the part of the people in our State Department, don't you think?
Of course. In January of 89, they wanted to hold a human rights conference in Baghdad 5 months after Saddam had unleashed the worst use of chemical weapons the world had seen since the end of World War I. And the only reason it didn't happen is the guy they wanted to send, a guy named Richard Schiffer, a Democrat, but a political appointee, but someone who is not part of the careerist culture, he said absolutely not, because he refused to be used as a prompt to hold hands and sing Kumbaya with Saddam.
Well, I think this is one of the most tragic episodes in recent history, and yet the average American doesn't understand what you're saying, because all they do is listen to Dan Rather and Rush Limbaugh, and neither one of them are telling the American people that we backed Saddam after he killed 100,000 of his own people.
Yeah.
In fact, actually, all those people were killed in 91 by the helicopter gunships. We could have stopped that at any time, and there was another 100,000 that were killed then. And we could have stopped them, but we allowed him, gave him permission to take those helicopter gunships and go down there and just mow down all those poor people in the southern part of Iraq who had believed in American president.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what's the solution? I mean, you've been reporting on this for some time. You've written an excellent book on that. And incidentally, for our listeners, Joel's book is Dangerous Diplomacy by Joel Mowbray. Are you still with National Review?
Oh, I'm just a syndicated columnist.
All right, fine. Well, as a syndicated columnist, what's the solution to the problem that you've posed?
Well, the solution to the problem is that you have to do everything you can to try to bring in new people, fresh blood, outside leadership into the State Department to change the way things operate. But remember, 98% of all the important positions are held by careerists, people who are not chosen by one administration. Next, they're there for life, and it's very difficult, and it's almost impossible to get rid of those people. In fact, the Secretary of State does not even have the authority to fire a convicted felon.
Well, now, why can't they do that? I mean, why doesn't Congress give them the right to do that?
I don't think Congress would do it, because the people who really control the process there are the people who are the head of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, and they can block anything that would be a reform of the State Department, because the State Department, frankly, doesn't want it. But consider this story. I know we're running up here out of time, but I'll just tell you this last story. There was a woman named Jamari Saleh who, back about 10, 15 years ago, had a problem with alcohol that led to a problem with fraud. And she filled out these expense reimbursement forms. She was a member of the Foreign Service, and she said that her children had been attending expensive private school. Trouble is, her children did not exist. And the prosecutors know what you can't get on this. So they brought her up on charges. And she plea-bargained down, but to a felony. And so she was a convicted felon. Now, when she went before the Foreign Service Grievance Board, which is a panel of Foreign Service officers, and the only group of people with the authority to fire someone from the Foreign Service, she said, the demon rum made me do it. The prosecutors didn't buy it, but the Foreign Service panel did. They let her keep her job. And when Warren Christopher found out about this, the Secretary of State under Clinton, a Democrat, proving once again this isn't necessarily a Democrat-Republican issue, he said, wait a second, I have a convicted felon working for me? He says, I don't care. I'm the Secretary of State. She's a convicted felon. She's gone. So he fired her. Well, she sued, she won, and she got her job back. And she got back pay. Because the Secretary of State does not have the authority to fire even a convicted felon.
Well, obviously, we have real serious problems there, and until somebody's willing to address this, somebody who has the courage to address it, why we're going to continue having problems. We're just about out of time, Joel. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners tonight?
Well, if they want to call their congressman or both their senators and let them know that they want to see the State Department reformed, that would always be helpful, and to let them know that they think the Secretary of State should have the authority to fire a convicted felon.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I also think that maybe we ought to be more concerned about freedom of the individual than supporting dictators throughout the world. I think this is something that, there is a right and there is a wrong. When we're supporting communist China, which has a totalitarian regime, you can make money over there, but don't you dare speak out against the government or you'll disappear and you may never be seen again. And these things still are happening over there. And nobody is ever really held responsible for what goes on. Joel, thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure. And I hope next time we can get you on, we can get a better telephone than that one you have.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Bye-bye. And our guest this evening has been Joel Mowbray. His book,
Dangerous
Diplomacy, it's available at bookstores. It's available through Amazon.com. It's a good read. We certainly recommend it for you. And we're going to have open lines this next half hour. So we welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Arthur Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to remind all the people here in the Central Coast of California or out across America, if you're listening to us, about the conference we're going to have. It's going to be on November 29th, 2 days after Thanksgiving, which is not the best time, but it was the only time we could get, and I did want to have a conference this year. And we're going to be talking on the USA Patriot Act. We're going to be talking about what's happening to the church as the Christian churches, thousands of them across America, tens of thousands of them, are being neutralized. They're changing the message of the church. They're changing the music of the church. And if you go to one of these churches and you don't want to go along with it, you're going to be asked to leave. Your life is going to be made very, very miserable. Doesn't sound very Christian, but then the church growth movement is not really very Christian. So if you really want to know about it, you'll want to hear the talk given by Dr. Robert Klink, who's gone all over the country trying to get the message out. Nobody wants to hear it. After all, if it works, it must be good. Well, Nazism worked very well, but it wasn't good. Benito Mussolini's fascism worked very well. They got the trains running on time, but it wasn't very good. And what's happening in America today can be traced directly back to the neutralization of the Christian church. We're going to be talking about Christian persecution, and there are plans for a massive persecution right here in the United States and throughout the world of Christians and of Jews and of fundamentalist Muslims. And then we certainly are going to be talking about health issues. We're going to be talking about why we're in Vietnam. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court. We're going to have a panel. And we hope that you're going to be able to come. Program's going to start at 8:30 in the morning, go through to 5. We'll be serving lunch. And we have a panel discussion at the end of the day. And so we hope as many of you possible will get your friends and relatives and bring them to the program. Now, we have to know ahead of time how many people are coming, so we're going to have to cut off reservations as of about next Monday because they had need to know how many people to plan for lunch. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and we hope that you'll be able to come, and I think you'll have a fascinating time. You'll, of course, get a syllabus when you come. It'll have a lot of the information that they're going to be talking about. So you can check it out, and we'll be making videos at that time. But some of these speeches are already available on video. You can get them. And what you can do, of course, is watch them several times and pick out the important points, learn how to present these issues so you can talk to other people about them. So remember the number to call, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-529-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we truly are at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and I apologize for the last half hour. Joel Mowbray, I just had a defective telephone, and there was no alternative. And I did want you to hear as much as you possibly could of what he was talking about, and that was basically that you hear about these massive graves over there in Iraq, and, oh, this wicked Saddam Hussein, and the women and children and little boys and little girls and men in these graves, hundreds of thousands of them. And we were backing him when he was doing that. And not only that, but during 1991, when he was machine gunning and killing another 100,000 people with a helicopter gunships that we allowed him to put in the air, and the people were slaughtered because they had listened to the American president, who told them, rise up, we'll come and help you. And they believed what they were told, and they paid for the deception with their lives. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we'd like to hear from you. But let me just talk a little bit about the American State Department, and I believe that Joel Mowbray is an excellent writer, and he is very dedicated and very sincere in what he says. But unless you understand that the American State Department was taken over by the members of the Council on Foreign Relations in 1945, and since 1953, every American Secretary of State, be they Democrat or Republican, has come from the membership roles of the Council on Foreign Relations. Not only that, but the Deputy Secretary of State usually comes from that organization, and all the Assistant Secretaries of State. And those of you who would like, we have an article written by Richard Harwood in the Washington Post in October of 1993, and he's talking about the Council on Foreign Relations control of our government. And we'll be glad to send you a copy of the article if you'd like it. And he says the President is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Secretary of State is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Deputy Secretary of State is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the five Assistant Secretaries of State come from the Council on Foreign Relations, and the legal advisor to the State Department comes from the Council on Foreign Relations, and then the Secretary, and he mentioned several other secretaries, and I've forgotten exactly which ones they are, but almost half the cabinet came from the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as the presidential advisor, David Gergen, and he goes right down the line. Then he talks about how all the major media is controlled by people who belong to this little group. And those of you who are regular listeners to Radio Liberty know that the Council on Foreign Relations was organized here in the United States in 1921. It was to be a front organization for a secret society that had been created by Cecil Rhodes in 1891 for the specific purpose of bringing about a world government and reuniting the United States and Great Britain, or at least getting them working together. Now, anybody who has any question about this, we have the statement that was written by Cecil Rhodes back in 1875. It's called A Confession of Faith, and we'll be glad to send it to any of our listeners who'd like to read that in its total. And this has been totally suppressed for many years. I was able to get a copy of this many, many years ago. And in this Confession of Faith, which Cecil Rhodes wrote, and you'll find many references to it in books about Cecil Rhodes, they'll just never tell you what it said. But what he said was, you know, the light dancing before my eyes is this: why should we not form a secret society to unite all the underdeveloped countries of the world under the control of the British Empire, and of course to bring the United States back into alliance with Great Britain? And then he talked about how they go to the universities and find the bright young men and recruit them into this secret society. And there was a secret society formed. It was formed in 1891, and you'll know that if you read the diary of William Stead, who was a member of the secret society. William Stead, who was an occultist, a spiritualist, a member of the Theosophical organization, was one of the four original members of Cecil Rhodes' secret society. He'd actually died on the Titanic when it went down, and he was thrown out of the secret society during the Boer War because he thought that somehow there was something wrong with creating wars to bring about world peace, because that was the purpose of the Cecil Rhodes secret society. And then we have the other writings by William Stead in Review of Reviews and elsewhere. We wrote openly about this secret society that was created. And then, of course, we know that Professor Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, found out about the secret society from Professor Zimmern, who belonged to the organization from about 1911 to about 1922, and told Professor Quigley about this secret society. If you read Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which is available through Radio Liberty, on page 951 and 952, you'll find out that following the First World War, there was a meeting of these intellectuals, these elitists, and in Great Britain and all throughout the British Empire, they created the Royal Institutes, the Royal Institute of International Affairs of Great Britain, of Canada, of New Zealand, of Australia, of South Africa, and the United States. They formed the Council on Foreign Relations, which was a front group for J.P. Morgan and for the Small American Roundtable Group, and that's what they called the group at that time. It was the Roundtable. The Roundtable was the front for the secret society. The Council on Foreign Relations was a front for the Roundtable. And just as today, the Project for the New American Century, the Foreign Policy Association, the World Affairs Councils, the ACLU, even the ADA, Anti-Defamation League and B'nai B'rith, all fronts for this Council on Foreign Relations, which creates all sorts of controlled opposition. And you find out, for instance, that George Bush is over there in Great Britain, and of course the demonstrations being held against him. But who's financing the demonstrators? Well, the communists, of course, organize these demonstrations all across the world. But who finances the communists? Who's always financed communism and the Communist Party here in the United States? And that's why you need to read the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, based upon the Reese Committee congressional investigation of the great tax-exempt foundations, Rockefeller, Ford, and Carnegie. Reese Committee actually held hearings in 1953 and 1954, and then, of course, the people of great wealth had to stop the investigation that already uncovered the fact that all of Kinsey's fraudulent research on sexuality and trying to popularize immorality in this country had been funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. They didn't want the American people to know that, and they certainly didn't want them to know that the Rockefeller and Ford and Carnegie Foundation had been funding communist and socialist front organizations in the United States. So they brought tremendous pressure to bear, and they stopped the investigation before it had been completed. We have a interview with Norman Dodd, who is director of research for the Reese Committee, and that's in our Secret Government 4-tape set. And we actually have a copy of the book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the Foundations, Their Power and Influence, which was written by Rennie Wormser, who was the counsel for the Reese Committee, where he goes into the things that they did, how they took over education and rewrote our textbooks and took over our universities. They even rewrote our Encyclopedia Britannicas. Why? Why they wanted to undermine belief in America and popularize this idea of collectivism. We needed an all-powerful government to control the people of great wealth. Whereas, in truth, it was the people of great wealth who were pushing this idea of socialism and collectivism, because they realized that once you could undermine our Constitution and this limited form of government we had, this government under God, where our freedom came from God, once you had all power in the government, centralized government, they could buy and sell the politicians at will, and that's exactly what they do today. So once you understand what's really going on, you can understand why people of great wealth are pushing socialism and have always pushed socialism while they protest so loudly against it. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. We'd like to know what you think of what we've been talking about, and of course, this greatest scam of all time, that the people of great wealth, and I'm not everybody of great wealth, some of them certainly are just people who've accumulated great wealth, but some of them are part of this Council on Foreign Relations, Bilderberger, Trilateral Commission, Council of Rome, Skull and Bone Society, banking, Masonic, Rosicrucian Theosophical Network, what I refer to as the Brotherhood of Darkness, Bohemian Grove, Order of the Quest, Hierarchy, they all are working towards exactly the same goal. The Lucius Trust, the World Future Society, they have an objective, a new world order and a new world religion. But the State Department, the American State Department, has always been under the control of the Council on Foreign Relations. So you really can't understand what Mr. Marbury is saying in his book, Dangerous Diplomacy, if you honestly believe that the State Department is operating independently. In other words, that the State Department is simply making mistakes. They don't make mistakes. They have brought communists to power all throughout the world, and only if they just don't go along with the system. Only if they are really making it difficult for our power elite are they eliminated, as they did with Allende, and he was, of course, killed, and the communist leader of Guatemala was killed, and there was tremendous carnage in both of those countries, but it was all coordinated by a central intelligence agency. And you can see them over in Iran, you know, toppling Mossadegh in 1954. In fact, Professor Quigley even talks about that in his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And if you haven't read the book, you really need to get it, because if you read the book for Mossadegh or for Schwarzkopf, remember the name Schwarzkopf? Well, back in 1954, there was a Colonel Schwarzkopf. He was General Schwarzkopf's father. And Colonel Schwarzkopf worked for the CIA and was instrumental in overthrowing Premier Mossadegh, who was a democratically elected leader of Iran, so they could install the Shah. And then they kept the Shah of Iran in until 1979, and then they toppled him to bring the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. And at the time, I can remember in 1979 pondering, why is it that they've toppled somebody who was our friend? He had the sixth largest military in the entire world. He was the bulwark against communism in the Middle East. And we topple him, and we bring a radical Islamic fundamentalist to power, the Ayatollah Khomeini, who had actually been financed and helped by the United States, during his years of exile. And now we topple the Shah, we bring him back, and then we have the seizure of the American embassy and the phony efforts to rescue the people there. And actually, I had the unique opportunity of talking to Ambassador William H. Sullivan, who'd been the American ambassador in Iraq. And you remember we had, supposedly we sent another of these helicopters, we were going to try to rescue the hostages. And he said, you know, to me, he said, I would hate to think that it's all been contrived. He said, I would hate to think that it was all show business, but that was my embassy. I was there, you know, and he'd been there until he'd been recalled, and then somebody else had been in the embassy when it was seized for the second time, and they were held for, a year or so, the hostages were held. But he said there is no way that rescue attempt could have possibly succeeded, and that's true. We didn't try to get the hostages out. This was all part of a game, and it all had to do with money. It had to do, the background of the hostage crisis in Iran, if I can just diverge for a moment, I'll tell you the background as I see it. And, of course, what had happened was, and this is what William H. Sullivan told me, that when he had been in Iran and they seized the embassy the first time, and then they held it for 10 days, and then they let everybody go, but they told Ambassador Sullivan that if America allowed the Shah of Iran to come to the United States, they would seize the embassy, the American embassy again, and hold the people hostage. So William H. Sullivan comes back and he tells Zygmunt Brzezinski and he tells President Carter and he tells the people of the State Department exactly that. If you bring the Shah here, they're going to seize our embassy over there in Iran. So what do we do? Why we bring the Shah to the United States for medical treatment, because he needs medical treatment, and then we bring a doctor in from Canada to do the treatment. Now, he could have gone to Canada, but it's sort of like waving a red flag in front of a bull. We knew it was going to happen, and sure enough, the Iranians moved in, seized our embassy, and then you know what we did? We seized all of the billions and billions and billions of dollars on deposit at the American banks that the Shah had here, which belonged to the Iranian people. Because our banks were in real trouble, they needed that money, and we had to have a justification for seizing it. And it wasn't until we were, our banks were in a position that, you know, they did not need the money anymore, that they negotiated the release of the hostages. And, I mean, if you want to talk about really phony theatrics, let me tell you about the morning that Ronald Reagan was inaugurated President of the United States. Now, I've heard this story from people who were actually there. And remember, the hostages had been in Iran, I don't know how long, how many months it had been or years it had been held, but this was one of the major reasons why people voted for Ronald Reagan, because Jimmy Carter was such a failure, he couldn't get the hostages out. His one attempt at extracting them had failed when our helicopters had crashed in the desert because they were getting dust or sand in their rotors. And at the time I thought, you know, our military is not that stupid. I mean, they're not going to send over those helicopters without filters on the motors, knowing full well they're going to be in the desert. I think that this is a phony rescue attempt, and I think it really was. Well, anyway, Jimmy Carter couldn't get the hostages released, and Ronald Reagan said, I will get the hostages released, and the people voted for Ronald Reagan. So he then is going to be inaugurated, and I believe it was either January or February. And as the story is told, it was raining that morning, and everybody was there with their umbrellas, and it was drizzling, and the sky was gray. And then just before the president is about to be inaugurated into become the president of the United States to swear on the on a Bible that he will uphold the Constitution, the announcement is made. They have released the hostages. The Americans are coming home. You can take off your yellow ribbons. At that very day when Ronald Reagan was being inaugurated, do you think that just happened by accident? And then, well, I'm sure the next thing really was an accident, but suddenly the clouds parted, the blue sky, the sun shines down on the rain-drenched people there with their umbrellas. They take their umbrellas down. The president is inaugurated, and the announcement is made, this is a new day for America. So that's the background of the hostages crisis that you're never going to hear from Rush Limbaugh or Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw, but I at least had first-hand knowledge of what was going on, having had the opportunity to interview William H. Sullivan at the place called the American Assembly at Columbia University back in 1980. And I only wish I'd had a video of our interview or even recorded it, but it was a fascinating insight. Although William H. Sullivan was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and almost worshipped David Rockefeller, who at that time was the chairman of the board, I don't think that he was a conspirator at all. I think he was just a man doing his job, and of course he'd been rewarded for good work and loyalty to the establishment and to David Rockefeller by being appointed ambassador to Vietnam, and he was actually with Kissinger in Paris negotiating the betrayal of Vietnam, and then he was appointed as ambassador to Iran, and after that he, of course, resigned and was not the ambassador at the time, the second time that the hostages were seized. But I would never forget William H. Sullivan talking to me about Vietnam, because he was there. And he said, Doctor, he said, the one thing I never understood is why we didn't try to actually win the war. We could have won the war in Vietnam at any time. I'm not a military man, but if they'd given me half a division or a few battalions of people, we could have invaded North Vietnam and ended the war in 2 months. I never understood why we didn't try to win the war. And of course, General Lewis Wald, a four-star Marine general, had personally told me the same thing. And you must understand, we never went to Vietnam to win the war. We never went to Vietnam to fight communism, because we financed the Russians all during that war, and then, of course, they financed the North Vietnamese. And for the background and documentation of that, we carry the book The Best Enemies Money Can Buy by Professor Anthony Sutton. And we even have an interview with Professor Sutton that I did back in 1980 when Professor Sutton, we took him back to Bob Jones University and film there in their film studio, and you can get that. It's called The Best Enemies Money Can Buy Video, or the book. Both are available from Radio Liberty. You need to understand the background of what's going on. Now, somebody had called and said a listener mentions that Marbury's interview was excellent, but somewhat hard to hear. And well, that was the problem I had. I thought it was an excellent interview, but he was fading in and out. I was having a hard time hearing him. And this is why, of course, he was only going to be with us for 30 minutes. And I wanted to keep him on because I wanted you to hear as much as of what he said as possible. And I thought it was fascinating, where he talked about how Saddam Hussein had killed 100,000 people, Kurds, in 1988. And who's backing him? Why, your State Department, which, of course, although Joel Mowbray didn't mention this, was controlled at that time by the Council on Foreign Relations, just as it is controlled today by members of the Council on Foreign Relations, as it has always been controlled. Because the Council on Foreign Relations, the front organization for the Round Table, which was a front organization for Cecil Rhodes Secret Society, is founded in the occult. And not everybody in it, of course, understands what it's all about, but the leaders understand it's about establishing the world government. And if you look beyond simply the title world government, you understand that this is to be the dictatorship of the Antichrist. This is what it's really all about. Going back for thousands of years, the mystery religions, of course, has been where the people have given themselves to the dark side, have worked within the secret societies and the mystery religions. And this was the message that was secret, that was always passed down by the sages from generation to generation. And that is, of course, that, first of all, you can be as gods, and we will work towards a one-world government. And that is the objective of the Council on Foreign Relations, of the Bilderbergers, of the Trilateral Commission, of the central bankers, of the great tax-exempt foundations, of the Skull and Bone Society, of the people who attend the Bilderberger meetings, of the hierarchy, of the spiritual hierarchy. And if you want to get their material, we actually have a little pamphlet they put out saying, we rule the world. That's what they say. Now, what I'm saying, if you want that pamphlet put out by the Lucius Trust, used to be the Lucifer Publishing House, but, oh, somehow Lucifer has a bad name. Foolish people out there don't really believe in Lucifer, so, or if they do believe in him, they think he's a bad guy. They don't understand that Lucifer stands for light. He's the enlightened one. He's the one that gives us true freedom. The God of the Bible, he has all these restrictions. Thou shalt not do this. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. And that probably even means thou shalt not have fornication. He's a killjoy. He's a cosmic killjoy. Whereas Lucifer says, do whatever thou wilt. That is the hold of the law. And the great trouble of today is we have so many people who follow the prince of this world rather than the God of the heavens. But this is the eternal battle. It's been there since the beginning of time, and it still persists today. And that is what's really behind the movement towards the world government, preparing this ruthless dictatorship. And believe me, their plans are to kill the Christians in this country and the Jews in this country and throughout the world, and the Muslims. And right now we're in the process over there of doing the devil's work of killing the fundamentalist Muslims. And I don't have any truck for the terrorists at all. They're absolutely wrong. But I don't believe what we ought to do is try to reach them and make them understand that they've been told a false, they've been given a false religion. The foundation of the Muslim religion is based upon Satanism. And you need to get our interviews with Craig Wynn to get into the background of the fact that where he'll actually document from the Muslim writings where Muhammad feared that, of course, he had been demonically possessed. And he, I honestly believe that most of his life. In fact, that was a great deal of what Salman Rushdie has a contract on his life for, because he wrote about this idea of the satanic verses and the fact that Muhammad was satanically possessed. So there is this battle. It's very, very real. And unfortunately, many people throughout the world, the vast majority of the people in the world, are on the wrong side or on the dark side, have embraced one or another aspect of the satanic religion. And there's only a small remnant even within modern-day Christendom where they understand what's going on. There's great apostasy within the church here in the United States. And our job is to try to get people educated. Well, amazingly enough, nobody's called in. I was hoping somebody would call in and we could talk about what you wanted to talk about. But if you don't, remember, you want to document what I've said tonight. The book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, goes into how the great tax-exempt foundations, Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford, financed socialism and communist front organizations in the United States. We wrote our textbooks and our encyclopedia to change America forever. If you want to get the background of Cecil Rhodes' Secret Society, the book, The Anglo-American Establishment, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and certainly our four-tape set on the secret government, will actually hear the interview with Professor Carol Quigley, who is Bill Clinton's mentor. Well, we're just about out of time. So for this hour, while we have to bid adieu to our listeners up in the Great Northwest and remind them, if there's any way you could come down for our conference on the 29th of November, it would certainly be worth your while. If you're interested, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know more about the conference, the 29th all-day-long conference, it's going to be outstanding, and you'll really begin to understand then what's happening to the church, why we're in Iraq, why the Supreme Court does what it does, and, well, we're out of time. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but we ask you to hold your calls for a few minutes. We're hoping that very, very soon we're going to have Joel Skousen on the line, and we're going to be talking about the latest analysis that you'll find in the World Affairs Brief, and hopefully he'll be back with us very, very shortly. But Joel is certainly one of the most perspective people, more perceptive people, I should say. I know. With an understanding of really what's going on. I mean, what's really happening in the Middle East? Certainly it's not what we're being told. Yes, I think that probably the government is making some headway in certain parts of the country in turning administration over to the Iraqis there and hiring the police and hiring the military. And some of the things we're doing are quite good. But certainly there still is unrest, specifically in the central part of the country. But the biggest problem we have is they are trying to put together a government over there that will be a government that we want, not that the Iraqi people want. What they need to do is set up a Republican form of government where equal representation from the south, from the central, and from the northern part of the country, and maybe even with representation for the Christians, because the Christians live, many of them, in the central part, where you find the Sunnis and the Ba'athist party, and then you've got the Kurds in the north, you've got the Shia Muslims in the south. And if you have a one-man, one-vote situation, true democracy. Why, you'll have one election, and you'll never have another election over there, because the Sunnis will win, and they'll set up a Islamic state. Now, we don't want that, and I don't think that's good for the people over there. I believe that they should set up a Republican form of government, with perhaps the Senate, and then Congress, very much as we have, one house that represents the people, elected democratically, the other house representing the regions, elected by the people in those regions. In fact, I think that Jay Leno had the best explanation and the best suggestion for what should be done over in Iraq. And he said, look, we want them to write a constitution. Why do we want to spend all the time having them write a constitution? Why don't we just send over our constitution, because we don't use it much anymore? Why don't we send them our constitution, because we don't use it much anymore? And what a sad commentary. Everybody laughed, but it's really true. Here in the United States, most Americans don't understand our Constitution, and certainly the people in Washington, D.C., who've sworn to uphold that Constitution, are actually dedicated to its destruction. And we don't use it much anymore, first of all, because the people don't understand, secondly, because the politicians want power, and thirdly, because the people who control the Council on Foreign Relations, the last thing that they want is a truly Republican form of government with limitation placed on what the central authority does. You see, the elite want to rule, and the only way they can do that is to do an end run around the Constitution, and they even talk about that in their own publications. And I believe it was in the article in April of 1974 in Foreign Affairs magazine, where Richard Gardner, who is a Rhodes Scholar and member of the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, he was Bill Clinton's ambassador. I think he was the ambassador to Spain. I could be mistaken, but he was an ambassador under Bill Clinton anyway. And Richard Gardner, writing in 1974, was talking about how we would have to do an end run around the Constitution, and how we would then bring in this world government through the World Trade Organization and the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade and the Treaty of the Seas and all these international treaties. And then we would have the world government, and those stupid people wouldn't even know how it came about. Well, he didn't say stupid people, but that was the inference. These elitists have total disdain for common folks like you and I. Joel Skousen, how are you tonight?
I'm just fine, Dr. Stan. Nice to be with you again.
Well, it is. Well, have you finished up your latest issue of World Affairs Brief?
No, I write it tomorrow.
All right, fine. Well, I don't know how you can get that all written in one day, but what would you like to talk about for this hour?
Well, we really need to talk about what the U.S. is planning in Iraq. The various changes that have been proposed, I believe, are more superficial than real. I don't think the U.S. intention of staying long-term in the military has changed at all. Certainly the projection of an Iraqi interim government is going to make the appearance of a transition look good for the United States. It's interesting that the United States uses this technique of playing bad cop, good cop routine with the United Nations. First of all, they start off lambasting the United Nations for not enforcing its own resolutions, acting unilaterally. And now today in England, Bush could speak nothing about the glories of multilateralism and looking forward to working with all his good friends in Europe and in Britain and working through the Iraq situation, appearing conciliatory. It's a real ruse that he plays, or at least the script that he reads. I know it's written by others for him.
No, I don't think he's capable of writing that on his own. In fact, he's not even capable of putting on a press conference unless all the questions and answers are scripted for him. That's really such an embarrassment to America. The leader of the greatest nation in the world is as incompetent as George Bush is, but listen to him when he's speaking impromptu rather than reading a speech. He reads a speech very well. I believe he's got some of the greatest speech writers in the world. But when he talks on his own, it sure doesn't sound very very professional. So, but you're absolutely right. They play this game back and forth. On one hand, they're against the United Nations. Now they're in favor of the United Nations. But you would agree that probably the real plan is to keep American troops permanently stationed in the Middle East?
Well, I believe that they want an American troop presence there in the heart of the Middle East so that they can play a major role in when this next Middle East war breaks out. It's clear that Egypt and Syria and Iran are planning on a massive missile attack on Israel. They don't intend to take Israel through conventional military force. Word has it that SN-22 Sunburn missiles have now been imported into Syria. These are very, very fast missiles that no anti-missile system so far has been devised to shoot them down. They were basically designed to be anti-ship missiles by the Russians to take out U.S. aircraft carriers, but they can be used for point targets. Apparently they're being mounted now on flatbed trucks and you know, are going to be used in the Middle East.
Now, is that the same Syria we gave $1 billion to back in 1990 for just being such nice people? And isn't that the same Egypt that we give something like $3 billion to every year to buy their support for peace so they can build up their military?
Yes, in fact, we've been arming them at an equal rate of Israel. This is part of the plan engineered under the original Bush administration, the Bush senior administration, to give equal play to both the Arabs and the Israelis. And, you know, the U.S. isn't stupid. They know very well that Egypt is still planning on attacking Israel. I think the globalist objective in Israel, of course, is to put Israel in a box so that militarily they will not be able to win the next war, and they will have to call upon the United Nations for intervention. It's very possible as well that Israel may become the trigger event of World War III. Surely Israel will be forced to use its nuclear deterrent to stop a massive Arab missile attack. The Israelis have the Arrow anti-missile system, which is an advanced version of the Patriot system, much more effective. But still, it's only capable of handling about 20 incoming targets at a time. I think the Arabs intend to throw a salvo of at least 100 to 200 missiles simultaneously into Israel. And this would overwhelm many military defense systems that Israel has, reduce Israel to, in shock value, to you know, a minor military power overnight, and they intend to then take it on conventionally after they've softened Israel up with a massive military strike. And this will be probably biological chemical warheads, which are sufficient to incapacitate a good percentage of Israel.
But of course, if the Israelis are faced with that, they would respond, I believe, with nuclear weapons and devastate the surrounding countries as well.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You have to ask yourself, though, what kind of nuclear deterrent is that to nations such as the Arabs, whose leaders really couldn't care too much for how many hundreds of thousands of their own people die? There isn't the same kind of you know, attitude about saving populations as there are, is in the West among this particular religious brand of fanaticism over there.
But
I think what is even more dangerous, though, is that Russia may well use an Israeli threat to use nuclear weapons or a U.S. intervention with the nuclear option as an excuse to take on the United States with a preemptive nuclear strike themselves. In other words, Russia has long been waiting for a trigger event that they can use to justify a preemptive strike on America to take America out of the picture.
Well, I think that most Americans don't understand that with all we hear about Russia and its weak military and it can't even pay its troops and, you know, they don't even have food stamps for the soldiers over there, but they have the greatest concentration of nuclear warheads anywhere in the world. They have over 7,000 nuclear warheads. They have the capacity to deliver them. They're building new intercontinental ballistic missiles, most of them mobile, while we are unilaterally disarming. And, of course, Putin says, gee, we just don't have the money to disarm. But they have the money to build new missiles that we don't have money for, because we're spending all of our money policing the whole world rather than defending America, and we have no effective deterrent in these anti-missile systems that they're putting in now that'll take down 20 missiles at the most. if they could hit any of them at all, I don't even know if they can, faced with a 7,000 nuclear warheads, the Soviets, the American people have, they're living in a fool's paradise. They have no idea what's happening, do they, Joel?
Well, no, and that's because Americans have become, by and large, totally dependent upon leadership. Leadership in the media, leadership in government, leadership at the state level. Whatever their leaders say, they've become dependent on that. And willingly trusting, all too trusting of leaders, I think it's a shame because Americans really don't want to be bothered with having to make the tough decisions or about governing a nation and about holding their citizenship and holding leaders accountable. When leaders betray their trust, as happens at the state level, at the national level, when they go back on their promises, as Bush has in denying his current conservative rhetoric, by implementing many pieces of socialist legislation, they simply do not get upset. They do not demand that he be ousted. They do not demand that Supreme Court justices be impeached. I just think it's almost impossible to hold politicians accountable nowadays, despite multiple lies and falsifications of the truth, because no one wants to be bothered with the very difficult process of admitting that we have to go back and fight for our liberty again. People simply don't want to be bothered. They want to, they will accept almost anything rather than having to use revolutionary force, as we did with our founding fathers, to correct the rise of tyranny again among nations.
Well, the difficulty is people look and they see we've got a choice between George Bush and, well, who will we have on the other side? Will we have Dean? Maybe Hillary, and they're still talking about Hillary running. I don't know if she's going to or not, but if I had a choice between George Bush and Hillary, I don't want either one of them. Or George Bush and Wesley Clark, or George Bush and Dean, that's like a choice between being shot or being hung. I just as soon pass both options. And there is no third party out there at all that has any chance, at least right at the present time, because it takes time and effort and finances on the part of the people. And as you say, nobody wants to commit themselves to do anything. We just want to be left alone and allowed to live our life. But unfortunately, they're not going to allow us to do that, are they?
No, they're not. And America has purposely been put to sleep, both educationally and media-wise. I think if Hillary does become a candidate, it appears at this point that she will probably wait for a draft Hillary movement at the convention. That could be very strong, given the kind of intense competition there will be between these various nondescript candidates that are running for president. None of them have swept the imagination of the American people to any degree, and I don't think they will. Speaking of third parties, too, I think that's one of the key points. Most Americans really aren't ideologically aligned in a strong way with other parties. Even conservatives who view themselves as conservatives don't really understand the nature of what they believe. They certainly don't seem to be willing hold anyone's feet to the fire and take political risks on the basis of their conservatism only. And even few constitutional conservatives do. So many of them will vote for the lesser of two evils out of fear of having an Al Gore or a Hillary Clinton win office. But, you know, the only possible solution, I suppose, of getting any real change is really to blow wide open the understanding that you and I have about conspiracy. It is on the issue that we have a conspiracy to take away liberty that has the only possibility of awakening sufficient people to cause a massive change in government. But even then, given the Italian experience of 1994, I'm even skeptical about our ability to pull off a change, even if we had a major error that would expose conspiracy in government. For example, in 1994, the Italians had the Manipoliti revolution there, where basically means clean hands. Everyone in the major political parties were finding, given bribes to governments and corporations in order to buy votes, and there were kickbacks on all kinds of Italian government contracts, and almost all the major political parties were involved in it, including the mafia. Well, so outraged was the public at these revelations that they completely ousted the existing political regime, the Social Democrats who've been in power ever since World War II. And but it's interesting that within a year and a half, they were all back in power again. They had reformed. They had switched and called their party a different name. They had put up new candidates, all claiming to be free from the dirty hands of the former conspiracy, but they were all back in power again within a year and a half.
Was that was there something about the P-52 Lodge or something?
Yes. Now, that was a different scandal. One of the Masonic lodges was, involved in heavy government influence, and so that was prior to the 1994 Money Politi scandal. But interestingly enough, Silvio Berlusconi took control, and then it was found out, of course, that he had a great deal of corruption involved in his media empire that he was allowed to raise up very quickly, and so he was put out of office. And it was only after the communists got back into power that people had sufficient dissatisfaction that they elected Berlusconi again. Now, Berlusconi is not part of the existing socialist regime that had been in power since World War II. The Social Democrats in Italy were much like the PRI party in Mexico. They'd been ruled. They were parts of the Socialist International, very strongly aligned with far-left communist parties. But in both cases, in Italy and in Mexico, we've seen those major parties defeated and a globalist candidate aligned with the United States put into power. Silvio Berlusconi is a wealthy businessman. He's got all kinds of ties with the Bush administration as well as Vicente Fox in Mexico. And I think this is a very dramatic coup where the United States has been able to engineer through its influences Anglo-American globalist candidates to take over countries that were originally lock solid in the hands of the Socialist International, which is, as I've explained before, a Moscow-driven front organization primarily based in Europe.
Well, no, but isn't this exactly what we're doing over there in Afghanistan, what we're doing in Iraq at the present time, is putting in administrations there that will go along with our agenda?
Precisely. Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan, of course, has deep roots within the oil corporations who hired him for many years. He's a puppet for the United States government. They've now got a strong man form of government in their new constitutional proposal. The Taliban have been isolated, although certainly not down and out. The Karzai regime is very unpopular. It only holds power within Kabul, and essentially the rest of the country has gone back to Taliban light, as they call it, leadership. The same thing's happening in Iraq. We have Ahmed Chalabi, who has been named, he's a true U.S. puppet, former head of the Iraqi National Congress. He ran the Petrobank out of Jordan to bankruptcy. It has all the markings of being a CIA front bank, where just like BCCI, the CIA pulled out their funds when it was about to be exposed. Chalabi left the country, was prosecuted, got a 22-year prison sentence hanging over his head. But now he's back in Iraq and being positioned as the interim head, and I think he's going to be named by the U.S. government as the interim head to take them through the new June date in which they will then pick a new constitutional proposal. In other words, they've simply delayed by these new announcements in Iraq. The Bremer team has delayed the onset of selecting a constitution and election date for another half a year until June to give them more maneuvering room. This gives them an excuse to put up Chalabi as an interim provisional chief of state there. He'll be given the appearance as if he's running things, but I think the U.S. fully intends to maintain lockstep control through these various puppet regimes that they're setting up in Iraq, and nothing literally will change in terms of U.S. hegemony over this particular nation in the Middle East.
Well, my estimation, and I'd like your thoughts on this, is that our real objective would be idealistically to take out Syria, Lebanon, topple the regime in Iran if we can, if not use military action. But we would like to topple these things, countries without the direct result of warfare, and then put into leadership there leaders that would go along with our agenda, our internationalist goals. Would you think this would be rational? Now, that's what we intend. We may very well end up, you know, involved, you know, in a nuclear war over there, but I think our leaders really are more or less pushing in that direction. What are your thoughts?
Actually, I don't think they are. I think that if they were, they would have been serious about trying to undermine and foment opposition groups in these countries before, and they haven't. They've really been supporting them. I mean, they supported the Ayatollah Khomeini in coming back and overthrowing the Shah. He was kept up in luxurious apartments in Paris for so many years, waiting to come back in. It was not destabilized. I think that they could have destabilized the Syrian regime. Certainly they could have had influence on Egypt by not giving them arms and by cutting off Russian arms. They have chosen not to do this. It gives every appearance to me as if they want to create conflict in the Middle East by sustaining these tyrannical regimes. I think the move, the sudden religion that George Bush has got about democracy has rather an excuse to create conflict in the Middle East. You know, the U.S. has had 50 years to push democracy among these people, and they've done nothing. They've only given excuses for the fact that these nations are tyrannical. And yet all of a sudden they are attempting to suddenly influence them, and he mentioned it in his speech to his hand-picked audience in Britain today. It went over again about having democracy in the Middle East. I mean, who's he kidding? Creating a Palestinian state, and he waxed very eloquent about the need to have their own government there, knowing historically that the Palestinian state is going to be a haven for terrorism. I mean, that's like saying we're going to have a change of government in Iraq, and we're going to let Saddam Hussein come back in and run the show, and he's a reformed person now. I mean, claiming that Arafat and his follow-along people are going to give peace to the Israelis because they give them sovereignty. I mean, there's no historical basis for this at all. I'm totally unconvinced that George Bush is simply naive and stupid enough to believe in this propaganda. I think there's an ulterior agenda here, and the agenda is conflict. So I really don't think that they are going to continue in the Iraqi version of democratizing either Iran or Syria or Egypt. I think, in fact, they're simply going to instigate continued conflict until some trigger is pulled in the Middle East.
Well, certainly we've been reading or hearing recently about the missiles now in Syria, the missiles in Egypt, and then, of course, the fact that Russia is threatening Israel if she should strike at Iran to try to put down her nuclear development. So is this simply something to get our attention off of what's really going on? Or do you think we are moving towards a crisis now? I know you've suggested that nothing serious is going to happen until after the 1908 Olympics in China. But is it possible that the situation is really heating up towards a crisis here in the Middle East in this next coming months or coming years?
I have no doubt, Stan, that there will be regional conflicts on almost a continual basis from now until World War III begins. And one of those regional conflicts will be a trigger event, and I believe it will most likely be in the Middle East, because that's where most of the conflict is. That's where the U.S. is concentrating on most of its on tactics of antagonizing the Muslim world, but also it could happen in the Far East, in Taiwan and South Korea. The reason I tend more to believe that the Middle East is going to be the source of constant regional wars is that the U.S. is continuing to antagonize the various parties in the Middle East while it continues to placate North Korea and induce governments in Taiwan and South Korea to make concessions, continued concessions to the bullies of the area, China, Russia, and North Korea.
Well, this certainly is the area that we could expect, and we would even, reading the Bible, we would anticipate that the coming conflict is going to originate in the Middle East, and certainly we see all the characters that are described in the Bible, just almost fitting into place like somebody was writing a script and that script is being followed along. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment for our guest, Joel Skousen, but right now let's tell our listeners how they can get hold of your World Affairs Brief and get hold of your excellent information.
Well, the World Affairs Brief is a weekly news analysis service that I write. It comes out every Friday, and they can read about it on my website, joelskousen.com, spelled JoelSkousen. And if they don't have access to the web, they can call my office during working hours, area code 801-224-4746, and ask for sample copies of the printed edition of the World Affairs Brief. We'll be happy to send you this last month's editions.
That's 804?
801.
801, yeah.
224-4746.
801-224-4746, if you'd like to get hold of Joel's material. I read it faithfully every time it comes in. Always an interesting slant on what's going on. And this information on the Sunburst missiles now, which are being deployed in the Middle East, this is really a rather frightening concept. You know, was everybody over there with missiles that can hit Israel? Why, I would think that people in Israel would not be sleeping very, very securely.
Well, you know, I've been over to Israel many times. They are just as asleep as American people, if not more so. There's probably more Americans that are concerned about conspiracy than there are in Israel. Although I will say that Barry Chamish, who has illuminated the Israeli government assassination of one of its own prime ministers, their version of our JFK assassination, has awakened many Israelis, especially on the right, to the concept that their government is in collusion with New World Order globalists, trying to undermine the very things that they pretend to protect. Interesting enough, the Russian immigrants there are some of the most conservative that there are. And I had a very open reception from most of the Russian press while I was there in Israel.
Well, we're going to have to take a break, and when we get back, we're going to welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I've got to remind everybody out there in the listening audience about our conference that we're having on the 29th of November, and I know you probably are tired of hearing about it, but there may be people tuning in who don't know that on the 29th of November, 2 days after Thanksgiving, Radio Liberty is putting on a day-long seminar at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, and we're going to have speakers coming in. Joan Paris is going to be there, and she's going to tell you what's really in the USA Patriot Act. She's read it through. She's got a very good analysis of it. You want to know what they're really talking about, because there's so much of the material in the USA Patriot Act which very, very few people have read, and even fewer really understand its implications. Then we're going to be talking about the great apostasy that's sweeping America today. Oh, we're getting more people into church all the time. Isn't it wonderful? But we're really not getting more believers in our churches all the time, because what the church growth movement is simply a marketing procedure that is taken from industry and wrapped in Christianese and then being presented to the American people as the hope of bringing people to Christ. And it's not going to bring anybody to Christ, because they're changing the message and the music of the church, and everybody's going to feel warm and fuzzy, but they're not preparing them for what I believe are the very difficult times that lie ahead. And when you set up a system of church growth designed into that to tell people who've been loyal members of that church for many years that, well, they probably would be happier if they left the church and invited them to leave the church, what sort of Christian ministry is that? Or is there another agenda behind the church growth movement? Will you not want to miss the talk that's going to be given by Dr. Robert Klink, who will, of course, go into the background of the church growth movement. And then we'll be having Bill Sardi will be there, bring us up to date on some of the really exciting things that are happening in the health industry. I'll be talking on what's happening in Iraq. Brad Dacus will be talking on Christian persecution. I will conclude talking about the Supreme Court and why the Supreme Court took God out of our schools and prayer out of our schools and the Ten Commandments out of our schools. And then we'll have an hour-long panel discussion, and you'll be able to ask everything you ever wanted to know and maybe were afraid to ask, and you can ask it there. Lunch will be served. We need to know how many people are going to be there because, of course, we have to have the lunches in, orders in. So you have till about next Monday to get your order in. Let us know if you're going to be there. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We certainly look forward to seeing you there at the coming conference. Well, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen, and if you're out there in the listening audience would like to call us, the number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And a listener had called in or didn't want to go on the air but wanted to know what the influence of the European super state would have upon what we're talking about in the Middle East.
Well, the European Union, which is heading for a Sovietized collective because of its false constitution, it really is a socialist collectivist type constitution. It has always been sponsoring the dysphonic peace movement in the Middle East, so they always have had a role. They have been promoting, for example, the Geneva Accords, this new alternative to the Bush roadmap. It's actually a much more radical proposal, and I think its true purpose is to be able to turn the Israeli public, who now have scrapped all the peace process and have lost confidence in any of them, to turn them back to the roadmap by saying, well, we're going to give you another proposal from the left in Israel, and it's going to be so egregious that you'll look back upon the roadmap with the nostalgia as a very mild proposal. I think that's what they intend to do by this. And this has been sponsored by the European Union. The European Union also now is about ready to enter into a role in Iraq. I'd like to comment on the recent statements by Javier Solana, the European Union foreign policy chief, who recently said the United States will begin to accept international control of its military in Iraq in the coming days. If these things are true, it would, of course, signal a major policy shift by the U.S. Mr. Solana, who is a Marxist, outright Marxist, part of the Socialist International, very closely aligned with Moscow, said that in the coming few days when Secretary of State Colin Powell visits, he's going to be outlining, I think Solana is indicating by this, that he's had secret confirmation by the United States that they're going to be inviting NATO into the process. And that's what Colin Powell is there to work out the arrangements. You know, NATO is technically separate from the EU, but there is a lot of seamless workings between NATO and the EU as well that really only distinguishable in difference by one has, complete control by the U.S., NATO, and the European Union does not, but only indirect control. What I think we're going to see here is that the U.S. is going to offer NATO, which they do have pretty good controls over, to come in and take up the peacekeeping role within Iraq within about 6 months. The U.S. would like nothing more than simply to be designated in an invited military presence by the new Iraqi temporary regime that's going to come into vogue in June, and go behind their barbed wire enclosures and their major military bases where they're not going to be subject to the kinds of guerrilla attacks that have been so unpopular with Americans. They'd like nothing more than have NATO troops take over the actual patrolling, as well as Iraqi troops to take over the patrolling of the countryside so that they can avoid the guerrilla warfare. I think that's what, I mean, what I'm saying is it doesn't really represent a change in the
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.